to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Written into the Constitution of the Eurozone is that really only banks should create credit and create it at interest. The governments should not provide money to the economy. Government should raise their money by selling off their public domain to private investors. The governments should not provide social services, should not provide infrastructure services, that all of these should be privatized, and that means building into their price structure interest charges, exorbitant salaries and economic rent for whatever the privatizers can charge.
And therein lies the problem of our reliance on private banks for issuance of our money the world over. That's our notable guest, Dr. Michael Hudson, recently returned from the Eurozone and consultations with Greek leaders, who is our featured guest today with Ellen. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree. Today, we'll be hearing more definitive insight into the foundational problems with our monetary system that is clearly failing to keep its end of the bargain of extending credit and financial liquidity into the economies of nations and peoples the world over. And while we don't want to overdo our focus on Greece's problems, they're so emblematic to our own financial situation that we ignore the lessons there at our peril. Whether you look at Detroit, Puerto Rico, or a host of other troubled economies, the same players are behind the destruction of local economies for the sake of private investor and gambler profits. Along the way, revolts start to bubble up from the discontent and unworkability of failed economies, and the Greek contagion has now spread to other countries. Ellen will offer some comments about why she thinks this indicates big changes are on the way, and we'll also examine a more central aspect of the situation, the need for broadly distributed financial liquidity for everyone if the system is going to work. And today we'll also have a short visit from Swami Biyandananda and some personal financial observations from Nomi Prins. So let's get started with Ellen's conversation with Michael Hudson.
It is my great honor and pleasure to be speaking with Michael Hudson, a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of a number of excellent books, most recently, The Bubble and Beyond. Michael has advised governments worldwide on finance and tax law, including Iceland, Latvia, China, and now Greece. Greetings, Michael. It's so great to be talking to you.
Good to be here. I wasn't a formal advisor. I just went to a meeting of the left Syriza group in Delphi and became part of the Delphi overall advisory group, but that wasn't officially with the government at all.
Mm-hmm. So can you just tell us in a nutshell what you see as the problem and whether there's any hope for Greece getting out of it?
Well, the problem is the Eurozone, which is basically a dead zone following austerity. The Eurozone really doesn't have a central bank that does what central banks are supposed to do, which is finance government deficit spending into the economy. The way an economy gets money and credit basically is for the governments to run a deficit and spend it into it. Any dollar bills or currency that you have in your pocket is a result of government spending. If the government didn't have any money to spend, there wouldn't be any. And after the Civil War in America, when the industrial North took over and raised tariffs, the government ran such a large surplus that it sucked money out of the economy, deflated the economy, and brought over a decade of deflation. The same thing happened after 1836 and 37 when Andrew Jackson closed the Second Bank of the United States. That led to the crash of 1837. So Europe is essentially following a guaranteed crash. It says the basic principle written into the Constitution of the Eurozone is that really only banks should create credit and create it at interest. The governments should not provide money to the economy. Government should raise their money by selling off their public domain to private investors. The governments should not provide social services, should not provide infrastructure services, that all of these should be privatized, and that means building into their price structure interest charges, exorbitant salaries, and economic rent for whatever the privatizers can charge. So the double-edged sword of being a member of the Eurozone is, number one, you don't have government credit to the economy. You don't have deficit spending. That's limited to 3% of GDP. You don't even have Keynesian recovery from a depression. You have to privatize and become a high-cost society. And unless you're Germany, your population has to be cut by 30%. Your wages have to be cut by about 40%. And they all have to emigrate to somewhere else, like Germany. Or wherever they can find work. And this is just a total disaster. That's what Greece found itself in and what it tried to get out of when it voted for the Syriza party. And when the Syriza people came in January, they thought, well, maybe we can reason with them. But what they didn't realize is that their economist, Yanis Varoufakis, was not talking to other economists. He wasn't talking to reasonable people. He was talking to lawyers. And the lawyers said, here are the rules. You got to follow them. The rules are written into the Constitution. You have to make an even a deeper depression. And Varoufakis and Tsipras, the prime minister, said, wait a minute. We've just had an election. The people have decided they don't want more austerity. They want to regrow, and we have a plan for regrowing. And they were told, the fact that you had an election means absolutely nothing. Elections don't change things. We already have the rules. It doesn't matter what democracy is. The Eurozone is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship by the banks. Banks are not elected. Voters don't have a role to play in that. If you join the Eurozone, forget what the voters say. Forget democracy. You're going to do what the banks say, and we're in it to make money for ourselves and for our clients. We're going to lend our clients enough money to buy your banks, your islands, your ports, any public utilities you have, your gas rights, and we're going to bankrupt you a little bit more. We're going to shrink you to such a low level that we can lend our clients money to buy your privatized land and enterprises very cheaply. And needless to say, Varoufakis said, well, maybe we can talk you out of it. And he spent about 6 months trying to talk them out of it, and then he realized he was getting absolutely nowhere, that they weren't in a talkative mood. And so finally they had a referendum, and by that time the Greek population got so angry, basically, at the Germans and at being told what to do, that they voted a very definite no. Well, at this point, there was an argument within the Syriza party. Varoufakis and the economic part of the left didn't want to pay the debt. They were prepared to go it alone and essentially be kicked out of the Eurozone. But the Greek politicians were afraid of this. They thought that this would result in an even worse crash than was being engineered by the Germans, and overruled Varoufakis. So he resigned, and most of the left wing of the Syriza people resigned, and that's the state of affairs we're in right now. It's sort of in a no-man's land, whereas Greece is still being told to privatize. It's refusing to privatize. It's being told to cut back pensions anymore. It's refused to do that. It's being told to raise the value-added tax to 23%, which is a very high tax. Imagine having to go to the store if you're an American and pay a 23% sales tax. You know, absolutely crazy. And what Tsipras and Varoufakis said was, look, we're willing to create more taxes, but what we want to do is to tax the wealthy tax evaders. And the Europeans got furious. They threw them out of the room. Now, you can't tax the rich. The rich are our clients. You can't tax the tax evaders because they're putting all their money in our banks. If you tax them, they won't have enough money to put in our banks as flight capital. So, I mean, it's a bizarre state of affairs. And the only positive thing to come out of it is that Spain and Portugal and Italy have now seen how poisonous the Eurozone really is.
So how can they get out of it? I guess Varoufakis had attempted to set up an alternative payment system just in case they had to leave the euro.
Yes.
Or leave.
Well, they had two suggestions as an emergency response. The first suggestion wasn't withdrawing from the euro. It's that Greece doesn't really have a central bank. What is called the Greek central bank works for the European Central Bank, and its job is to bankrupt the Greek banks, not to support them. Its job was to pull the plug and create an artificial crisis where everybody had to go to the ATM machines by depriving the banks of liquidity. So what's needed is a real central bank, or what used to be in America the Treasury, and what in most countries is the Treasury. Varoufakis wanted to create Treasury promissory notes that could be used for paying taxes. This is basically the state theory of money, that the government would simply spend its own money denominated in euros into the economy, and that would fuel the economy. At the same time, the plan was, now that the European Central Bank in Europe was not supporting the Greek banks at all, just stop paying the foreign debt. The parliament there had a large meeting on odious debt, called the Debt Truth Commission, and they found good reasons not to pay Greece's foreign debt to the IMF or the European Commission or the European Central Bank, all called the Troika, because back in 2011 and 12, when the International Monetary Fund agreed to join the Troika, the IMF staff economists themselves said, we can't make this loan under IMF rules. Greece can't pay the current debt. It would be a disaster to make the loan because the loan's going to go bad almost immediately. And unfortunately, the head of the IMF was in a total conflict of interest. That was Dominique Strauss-Kahn. And Strauss-Kahn, at the time, the IMF had hardly any customers in the world. Just about every country in the world wanted to be as far away from the IMF as they could be, because the IMF's medicine for everything is cause austerity, cut your labor costs 30%, and support the banking system, and essentially representing the 1% against the 99%. Well, Strauss-Kahn wanted to run as president for France, and the largest group of bondholders of Greek bonds were the French banks. So Sarkozy and France said, look, you've got to support the French banks. You can't expect to run for president and then pull the plug on the French banks. And also, the European Central Bank said, wait a minute, if you want to be part of the Troika, if you want to join us in this, you have to support our hard line. If you say that the Greeks can't pay, that's not what we say. We say any country can pay any sum of foreign debt if only it lowers wages by enough. So all we have to do is lower wages by enough. You know, and if Greece can't pay, fine, we'll just make it sell all the property, the islands, the gas rates, and everything else. So the price of the IMF joining with the European Central Bank and the European Commission was to violate its articles of agreement that say that the IMF can only make a loan to a country with a reasonable ability to pay, defined as being able to turn this debt over to the private markets. Well, no private market was going to buy Greek bonds, because the private markets at that time were pricing Greek bonds at only one-third of the face value, meaning that they knew that Greece couldn't pay. So somehow Greece made this loan. The current Greek Debt Truth Commission said, wait a minute, there should be a basic rule that if a government organization or any creditor makes a loan to a debtor, knowing in advance that the debtor can't pay and the intention is to foreclose, that's an odious debt. That debt is just leverage to grab property, and it doesn't have to be paid. We're a sovereign government. The Greek prime minister at that time, Papandreou, wanted to hold a referendum, and Angela Merkel said, you can't hold a referendum. They're going to vote against it, and removed the Prime Minister Papandreou in favor of a central banker, the same central banker who had worked with Goldman Sachs to falsify Greece's foreign debt in 2001 when it originally faked its statistics to be able to join the Eurozone. So the whole financial situation of Greece was a put-up job. And there's a good argument for throwing it into the courts, which would probably take 10 years, maybe 20 years to settle. And in the meanwhile, Greece wouldn't have many problems at all once it doesn't have to pay the troika, the intergovernment organizations that took over the debt. Its payments would be in a pretty good state. It wouldn't have to devalue. It would be okay.
So they can go to, have they gone to court? And
no.
That's an automatic stay on whether they
No, they haven't gone to court, and they haven't made the claim, and they're still paying the debt. And by all the money that they're borrowing from Europe is simply to pay back Europe. So it's purely a bookkeeping mm-hmm. operation. Money is lent to Greece. It's paid right back. So in effect, Greece's debt is expanding at a compound interest exponentially. Any compound interest is a doubling time, as we've spoken about before. And it hasn't really tried to make any use of resist these demands for austerity.
Why haven't they gone to court, though? They did the Truth Commission, and they
because they think that this would make Europe angry, and they don't want to make Europe angry.
Mm.
They want to win a they think that somehow they can convince, they can talk reason to Europe. And it's like if you're a debtor and you owe the bank money and you go to the bank and say, wait a minute, I really can't pay, you know, my sister's sick or whatever, and I have, you know, can't you be reasonable? And the bank will say, I'm sorry, we can't be reasonable. You owe us the money. You know, we're going to have to foreclose on your house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a asymmetrical situation there.
So how would they get out? Should they go to the drachma, or is that not a feasible?
They don't have to go to the drachma. All they have to do is stop paying the debts. They should be prepared to say, look, if you we're not going to withdraw from the Eurozone. I don't even know how they do that legally. If you want to kick us out of the Eurozone, that's fine, but we're going to print Euro-denominated IOUs, and we're going to continue to use the Euro. And the problem is that the European Central Bank then would say, okay, we're not going to support the Greek banks anymore. Well, one of the things that we discussed in Delphi was the banks in Greece are owned by the oligarchs, and the European banks are very predatory. They're trying to buy the Greek banks. So we thought, well, wait, it's not a bad thing. If the banks are broke and the European Central Bank drives the Greek banks under, then you've just destroyed the oligarchs' means of controlling the economy. So the government can take them over, just like the U.S. government could have taken over Citibank, or just like the FDIC took over Washington Mutual and Continental Illinois. The government could have taken them over and run these Greek banks all of a sudden as a public option, in the public interest. And instead of the banks being used by the oligarchs as flight capital to get their money out of Greece, the banks could have been used to actually finance Greek business and the domestic Greek economy, and helped the Greek economy grow instead of shrink.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of hard to, I totally agree with that. I mean, the public option is definitely where they should go or should have gone long ago. But it is hard to envision how they're going to use euros that they print. I mean, what if every country printed
wouldn't print
its own
the euro
euros?
Notes.
Doesn't that dilute
They wouldn't print the euro notes. They would print IOUs denominated in dollars. Now, you and I cannot print dollar bills, but we can write IOUs that are denominated in dollars. I can write something, you know, I can write a bond saying I owe Ellen Brown $1,000, and mm-hmm. you can, you know, trade this. It's denominated in dollars. We don't have to print dollars.
Yeah.
They don't have to print euros.
Right, because virtually all money is created as in the form of a loan anyway. So if you
That's
own the
right.
banks, you can expand the money supply by making a lot of loans. The only problem is leakage when people withdraw money and put it under the mattress, or when they transfer it out of the country. So how do you impose capital controls to avoid
wouldn't really need them if the government took over the banks, which are already broke. So the government, and the government already is a major owner of the bank. It just leaves the management in the hands of the oligarchs. In terms of the domestic euros, the Greeks have already been pulling out all their money from the banks in a domestic drain. Either they're holding euro notes, or as Jamie Galbraith pointed out to me, the Greeks in the last 6 months have been buying cars, consumer goods, even boats. And that if Greece went to the drachma, or had a crash, then the Greeks could at least sell these cars. They could drive them, you know, up to Albania and sell the cars there. Cars have a resale value. Boats have a resale value. So the Greeks had pretty much protected themselves against this. Capital controls could have been imposed by the banks in terms of large transfers of money abroad. But in terms of euros, the Greeks basically simply need enough euros and enough domestic currency to operate. And the capital controls would almost be imposed by Europe, the European Central Bank, by trying to freeze out the Greek banks.
Mm-hmm. Which they couldn't do if it was all digital. I mean, as long as they stay digital, right? They're just dealing in checks and credit cards. And the ECB wouldn't be able to freeze them out? I mean, they can only freeze them out from printed euros. Right?
That's not the technicalities there are not really my department. But I think that they weren't worried about that. They thought that they'd solved that problem. When you and I were in Malaysia, it was explained to us how Malaysia had solved that problem.
Yeah, I totally think they should go the way Malaysia went.
Yep.
Although that did get Malaysia in a fair amount of trouble, I think. But I mean, it worked.
Well, the trouble Malaysia had was not because of the capital controls. It was because of the Malaysian domestic political situation.
Right. It got them into political trouble. Yeah. All very interesting. You had written about the German economic miracle and how it had followed massive debt forgiveness by the Allies, where they annulled all the domestic
debt. Yes, it's very
debt.
Curious that the discussion of this has not been taking place more. The Allied currency reform of 1948 abolished all domestic German debt, except for the payroll debts that employers owed their employees, and except for, you know, basic minimum working balances. And the reason that the Allies were able to do this is that most of the German debts back in 1947 and 48 were owed to the Nazis or the ex-Nazis. So they were basically canceling debts to people who they'd held responsible for the war. So Germany was freed from domestic debt, and that made it one of the lowest cost economies in the world. Then in 1953, Germany's foreign debt was written down, the debt that it owed ostensibly for reparations in World War I and others. So first, Germany's domestic debt was written down in a clean slate, the Allied monetary reform, and then the foreign debt was written down. And what they called the economic miracle wasn't really free markets. It was markets that were free of debt.
So that obviously worked brilliantly well, and the Germans saw it themselves. So why are they so resistant? I mean, I assume it's not the German people. It's someone else.
Yeah, they're pulling up the ladder. The beneficiaries have been the German banks, and the German banks mm-hmm. are as predatory as banks in other parts of the world. After World War II, the United States was very careful to put in the most right-wing people they could, just as Operation Paperclip brought most of the ex-Nazis to the United States. So the Americans backed the right-wingers in Germany as they backed the Yakuza and the right-wingers in Japan. And so Germany became an economy dominated by the banks that are extremely right-wing, and followed the same logic that was used to extract German reparations against Germany in World War One.
And your latest book is called The Bubble and Beyond.
Yes, so, and I have another book that will come out next month called Killing the Host, How Finance Capitalism is Destroying Industrial Capitalism.
Oh, cool. I'll look for it.
Counterpunch will be publishing it.
Oh, cool. We're at the beyond, and it's looking kind of like a big abyss. So how do we get out of it? Not just Europe, but I mean in general. In the U.S., we're obviously doing
well,
better
than
they are.
Well, the beyond really turned out to be foreclosure time. In 2008, Obama had come to office promising that he was going to write down the bad mortgage debts to the amount that people could pay. But instead, he didn't write down the debts. Instead, he bailed out his campaign contributors, the major Wall Street bankers, and he put Wall Street lobbyists, such as Tim Geithner, in charge of the Treasury, essentially to double-cross all the people that had voted for him and to be Wall Street's candidate. How do we get out of it? There's no way that you can get out of the current malaise that we're in as long as you keep the debts on the books, and the debts were never written down. And nobody's really talking about the debt issue. I mean, you and I are talking about it, but the politicians aren't talking about it. It looks like things are just going to be a slow crash. Nothing fast, just a gradual slow crash, a tightening of living standards, raising charges on Americans, and a whole continued shift of wealth and income to the 1%.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the problem, that we write and we think we know the answer, but they own the media and they've got the power. How do we?
Well, we're in the same problem that Greece is in. That's exactly the problem there. The media are all owned by the oligarchs there. People believe, what's in the media. And fortunately, the internet gives you and me a chance to express ourselves, and we have, interested people following us. But what we talk about is not in the economics curriculum that's even discussed in the schools. Apart from University of Missouri at Kansas City, maybe a few other places, hardly anybody's talking about the role of finance and how what people think is the American economy is really two economies. It's the finance and insurance and real estate sector, the rentier class, as opposed to the labor, and everybody's interest is all the same. And you really have a situation now where the interests of Wall Street are opposed to the rest of the economy, but Wall Street is the major funder of both political parties, both in the presidential campaign, in the court system, and in the media. So it's very hard to break through the idea that somehow if only the banks can now make more money, if only the Federal Reserve can create another $4 trillion in quantitative easing and give to the banks, that's going to somehow help the people instead of helping the banks.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me in some ways it's more difficult here in the U.S. because it's just not obvious the devastation that's been wrought on the poor, that most people drive around and see everything looking fine. They watch TV, which seems fine. Seems like we're prosperous, unless you really dig into what's happening and how people have been forced out of their property and now they're having to pay rents that they can't afford and so forth. But so maybe arguably we need a crisis like Greece. I mean, in some ways, maybe things are more promising there on the cutting edge, or on the crisis edge, where they have to do something.
Of Southern Europe is certainly watching the Greek crisis. And the interesting thing, though, is that who's protesting against this financial austerity? It's not the left wing. The social democratic parties in Europe are now, they would be called right wingers now. They're to the right wing of the Republican Party here. The Social Democratic Party of Greece under Papandreou were the ones who led the austerity movement. The French Socialist Party under Hollande is leading the austerity movement. The Socialist Party of Spain, right wing, leading the austerity movement. And they were the people who were taking the hard line towards Greece and saying, no, don't forgive any of its debts. The people who are opposing Europe are the right wing of all. In France, Marie Le Pen, in Italy, the right wing, in Hungary, the right wing. So it's the question is, why is only the right wing protesting against financial austerity? Why is the left wing, the Labour parties, the Tony Blair groups in England, or the Democratic Party here, which is what used to be called, if we were using the terminology of 20 years ago, the Democratic Party would be called right wing, and that's because it's become the austerity party too. Why is only the right wing complaining about this?
Mm-hmm. And that almost seems to be true here too, that it's the libertarian wing that talks about money reform, whereas the Democrats or the left isn't.
Yes, unfortunately, the libertarian reform tends to be gold bugs and wants to go back to even harder money that would make austerity even worse. So the problem is that when the right wing talks about monetary reform, it doesn't know what money is. And when you and I talk about it, we know that money is credit, and that you create money by creating a credit, and neither the right wing nor the left believe this. Paul Krugman says that it's impossible for banks to create credit, you know, in his infamous debate with Steve Keen that everybody should read because it's so wonderfully humorous, where Steve was trying to explain that banks do create credit, and Paul Krugman said, no, banks just lend out savings. He thinks commercial banks are savings banks, and that's what he was taught in college, and you know, that's basically why he got the Nobel Prize, for not understanding money. That's the precondition for getting the Nobel Prize. You have to, if you understand money, then you're disqualified.
I think that is the problem, that people don't understand banking. They don't understand that it's actually a factor in all this. They think that banks are just intermediaries. They take in money and then they lend it out, and that's not what they do, as the Bank of England just acknowledged recently. So maybe
the Bank of England has been doing wonderful material. IMF research director has been driving out anyone who's reasonable, anyone who doesn't believe that you should cut wages and you stabilize finances by austerity, is just fired. So they had one good guy that you and I have met often, Michael
Kumhoff,
and he left. He's happy with the Bank of England now. There are a lot of people there. Steve Keen went from Australia to London, and he's meets with the Bank of England occasionally. So the Bank of England is really taking the lead in popularizing what money really is and what credit really is, and trying to develop a credit system that it will use money to actually help the economy rather than act in a predatory way.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that was prompted by the positive money people that actually had hearings in Parliament on where money comes from. So I don't know if we'll ever get to that point where we manage to have hearings in front of Congress.
Well, Bernie Sanders has appointed the former department head of Kansas City, Stephanie Kelton, as the Congressional Budget Office and Statistics. So she's certainly making it clear. And there was just speaking of Greece, there was just a discussion in Washington with Bernie Sanders, and Stephanie was moderating the debate, and Jamie Galbraith was there, and Stiglitz was there. So I'm sure that's available on the Internet. If people want to go and see the discussion there, you'll have exactly what we're talking about now discussed in Washington.
I think it's great that you're advising in Greece and that you keep on pushing with all these ideas. I've gotten a lot of insights from your work.
Well, you're doing a lot of good writing, too. I mean, there are not that many people who are really writing, so the listeners should read both of our reports.
Thanks. Okay, great. And Bubble and Beyond, and your new book is
Killing the Host.
Oh, right. Okay. Thank you so much.
Great. It's good to talk to you, Ellen.
You too. I've been talking with Michael Hudson, Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of many books.
And now a little break in our focus for some funny money meditation by Swami Beyondananda.
This is Swami Beyondananda speaking to you on behalf of the Public Banking Institute. Yes, I know, it sounds like a contradiction in terms, public and banking. You know, I don't know about you, but I am so nostalgic for those good old days. Remember when people robbed banks? Well, of course, now it's the other way around. And the purpose of the Fed seems to be to feed the underfed to the overfed. Well, anyway, today's news is that Puerto Rico, like Greece, is having a near-debt experience. Yes, Puerto Rico was promised pie in the sky and the NAFTA life, but life after NAFTA isn't that rosy at all. For one thing, jobs went to regions where it is easier to exploit workers and pay them less. Well, that's understandable. It's called globalization, but I call it gobblization. That is the practice of mining the global economy by saying, that's mine, that's mine, that's mine, so that greedy turkeys gobble everything up. Fortunately, there is an uprising afoot. That is where a critical mass of the heretofore uncritical masses wake up and wise up. And instead of being owned by the bankers, we own a bank of our own. Yes, I know. I am proposing a sane world. I must be crazy. Well, that is why I appreciate the Public Banking Institute. They are looking to turn California and the world into one big sane asylum. Oh, my higher plane awaits, and I must sign off. This is Swami Beyondananda. Namaste and namasko. Goodbye.
Thanks to Steve Behrman, also known as Swami Beyondananda, for his relief efforts to our financial concentration. You can find the Swami and other alter egos of Steve at wakeuplaughing.com. So, with the tensions all over the world around money and monetary control playing out in all kinds of different settings, Ellen is having some thoughts about revolt and revolution.
Well, we have a revolution going on in the sense that everybody is angry, and they're angry with the ruling class. This is an article that Robert Reich did recently. Right. There's a revolt going on in Washington, but political insiders just can't see it. That's the name of his article.
The mood for revolution is present.
It is, indeed. It's in the U.S., and it's present in Europe. In Europe, we can see it in that it's become obvious to all the radical left parties that they're going to wind up the same way Greece did. And so they are talking revolution, according to Ambrose Evans Pritchard in The Guardian recently. In fact, this is such a cool article. I think I'll just quote a bit from it, if I may. He says, he's talking about the fact that Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, is being sued for treason just because he was attempting to set up a parallel system if liquidity had been cut off by the ECB, which it actually was. And you could argue that the ECB was acting illegally because that's the European Central Bank, that it has a duty to provide liquidity. In fact, that's what I've written about in my last couple of articles. So they were acting illegally. But they're calling it treason, the fact that Greece would dare to come up with an alternative system. The one obviously illegal thing that Varoufakis did or was talking about doing was to hack into the banking data, which it's their own banking system, and he was the finance minister, but he didn't have control of it. The data was under the control of a foreign power, essentially, the ECB, which is on foreign territory.
What you're describing there is that the ECB had oversight or control of the Greek National Bank, which is really privately held, isn't it?
Well, the central bank should have been under the province of the Greek finance minister, but he didn't have control of it. So he didn't have access to the records to their own bank, to their own central bank. So if they were going to set up their own system, either as euros, which you could do it still as euros, you just need to, you can create liquidity just by creating loans, or if they took control and went back to the drachma, they would need all the records. I mean, you've got to know who all the customers are and how much money they have, and you've got to figure out how to convert them over to drachmas and so forth. So you need all those records. So to get them, they would have had to hack into the ECB's records, or which is their own central bank's record. So that arguably that was colorably illegal. But even so, that is not treason. So he's being sued for treason, which is, you know, it's a political thing. So these other leaders in Italy and Spain can see that it's going to go the same way for them. And so they're coming out with these very revolutionary statements. The leader of the Podemos movement in Spain, Pablo Iglesias, accused Germany of imposing a Carthaginian settlement as punishment for daring to call a referendum, and warned that the limits of democracy in Europe are now brutally clear. And then in Italy, which actually their economy is doing worse than the Spanish economy, Ambrose Evans Pritchard quotes Stefano Fassina, the ex-deputy finance minister in the ruling Democratic Party of Matteo Renzi, is already proposing a controlled disintegration of the Eurozone to break free from what he calls a neoliberal mercantilism imposed by Germany.
Wow.
We are at a historical watershed. The choice is dramatic, he said. Syriza and the Greek party have the undeniable historical merit of having ripped away the veil of Europeanist rhetoric, he said. Evoking the language of guerrilla warfare, Bistris Fassina is calling for an alliance of national liberation fronts on the left, acting in concert with sovereignty parties on the democratic right.
Uh-huh.
And Ambrose Evans Pritchard said, this is a recipe for a European civil war. So that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
And then in the U.S., what we have going on is a revolt in that the leading Republican candidate is Donald Trump, who the media has made out to be sort of a buffoon and an egotist and so forth, and that he doesn't possibly have a chance. But he obviously does. He's got 31% of the vote, which is way more than anybody else in polls.
Yeah.
And why is that? It's because everybody is disgusted and angry with this whole ruling class. Apparently, the super PACs are now packing in one-third of all federal election funds raised in the first half of 2015, up from 4% in the last presidential election. And so these are mostly people with $100,000 or more. I mean, this is the elite who, we've always had an elite, but now the elite are clearly not acting in our interests. I mean, people are so disgusted with the big banks and just everything that's gone on in the last decade or so. First, it was the Tea Party on the right, and then Donald Trump kind of is the personification of that, where Donald Trump is the wrecking ball who criticizes all the other candidates, exposes what's wrong with them. And on the left, we have Bernie Sanders, who is the rebuilder. But in both cases, it seems to me, this is our shot at monetary reform, because they're, both of them have shown an interest. Well, Donald Trump is anti-big bank. And here's the advantage of Donald Trump. He is the only guy who is not dependent on other people's
money.
Big money. He's got his own big money.
Yeah.
So he's like Kennedy. I know somebody who said that the problem with Kennedy was he really thought he was president. Like, he was the last real president we had who actually acted on his own. And, of course, what happened was he wound up getting killed. But still, his family had their money, and he got elected on his own steam, and he was able to say what he thought. And Donald Trump would be the same way. And if he's opposed to the big banks, he could get in there and do some changes, it seems to me. And so could Bernie Sanders, and he's clearly expressed an interest in monetary reform. It sounds like he probably wouldn't come out and say he was like for public banking or for government-issued money, et cetera, quantitative easing for infrastructure, all those things that we think should happen. He probably wouldn't come out and vocalize that until after he got elected, and then there's a question whether he would get elected. But still, it's a very interesting development that we have revolution going on all over the place. It seems to me it's the time and the mood of big change. So interesting times, developments to watch.
Well, when you starve the people in the cage, or the animals in the cage, they get angry, and there's trouble to be had. So obviously that's what we're seeing around the country and the globe. I noticed that of the 21 countries that use the euro as their currency, half of them, their economies have shrunk since 2007. Whereas the floater countries, you know, like England and the others that didn't adopt the euro, have not had any downward cycling in their own local economies. So the euro is under enormous stress, isn't it? And one wonders what kind of emerging monetary system could develop. What kind of an alternative do you think they would go to?
Well, assuming they abandon the euro altogether, which they wouldn't necessarily have to, but assuming they did, I mean, you can continue, you can use any currency, like Ecuador uses the U.S. dollar. But assuming they abandon the euro and went back to their own prior currencies, they can do some pretty new and creative things now. That, I mean, there's, money reform has gotten to be a popular topic. Look at what's going on in England, where the Bank of England has come out and said that banks actually create our money. Mm-hmm. And the Positive Money Group managed to have a hearing in Parliament on monetary reform. So people are becoming more and more aware that the banking system itself is the problem, and that it's the structure of the banking system, that the banks are not merely intermediaries that take in our money and then lend it out to somebody else. They are actually creating our money. And we should and could take that power back. So all those countries could do something new and very interesting. So I'm sort of hopeful.
So what used to be the role of the central bank to issue credit, and because the countries in Europe don't have their own central banks, they have to rely on the issuance of credit by the central bank of the EU, but that central bank is in the control of the global banks. So the bottom line is that the global bankers really are turning on or turning off the prospect of economic survival for these countries.
Yeah, and this time around, they could do something new and different. They don't have to go back to the old system, the pre-euro system.
And I think part of the revolution also includes the conversation that's emerging about giving a basic income to people. Can't we just afford to give people a decent basic means to be alive? Doesn't that make sense? And it does economically, doesn't it?
Definitely. And if you own the bank, if you own your central bank, or you allow your treasury to actually issue money, obviously you've got the money because you've got the power to create money. So they could do it. And then the only question is whether that's going to be inflationary. That's what always stops those proposals, but it won't be inflationary because of the nature of our system, where even, let's assume that 50% of the money comes into existence as a loan from a bank, which, I mean, all of it does now. But let's assume that the Treasury or the central bank takes back some of that power by actually issuing some money to fill up the gap. There is a gap. That's the problem. If you create the money as a debt and you always require more money coming back into the bank as went out in the form of interest. So over a 30-year loan, you're requiring twice as much to be paid back as you put out there. There's always going to be a shortage of money in the system. You've got to put more money out there just to get, you know, if one of your mandates is full employment, which is a mandate of the Federal Reserve, in order to create full employment, you've got to get the money out there first. It's just like Keynes said, you could bury money and dig it back up, or Milton Friedman said, you could drop it from helicopters in order to fill up what the social creditors call the gap. There's necessarily going to be a gap between the money that it takes to create products, if you've got these extra expenses that you can't recover in the price, and what you're going to pay your workers. So the workers are never going to have enough money to buy your products unless you give them a little extra money. So you're going to have to fill that up by creating money. You can drop it from helicopters. But the thing about the helicopter money, we've done that already with quantitative easing, but the helicopters have only flown over Wall Street. What you want to do is get those helicopters dropping money right into the pockets of the people who will be out there purchasing the products.
I can see a lot of people out in the yard painting big H's. Please land here. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Okay, thank you.
Part part of what we offer now comes in the form of a sort of public service commentary on what you might choose to consider about your own stash of cash. What do all these global machinations of the banking world mean to you and your financial assets and concerns? Bank accounts pay nothing in the form of interest returns. The stock market is said to be heavily inflated, and the bets, or investments, if you will, of the global bankers, are fraught with problems that make the world more precarious. Should you be thinking about anticipating some change in the management of your own dollars? Well, we've said a lot about Greece and how their economy deferred to the threat of getting cut off from their funds, and the suffering that those people have gone through to deal with being deprived of their cash assets by the banks. You know, closed ATMs and things like that. And of course, we've told you about the bail-ins of depositor money that are ordered should a new banking crisis occur. So let's listen to someone who knows and follows this world intimately, a colleague and guest on this program, noted author and financial expert Nomi Prins, about why you might consider front-running the next bank crisis by keeping some of your cash on hand. Here's a comment that Nomi made while talking with another friend and guest of this program, Greg Hunter, on his show, USAWatchdog.com.
I believe behind the scenes, there are probably a lot of fearful conversations about the financial system, not just the relationship of Greece and the euro idea politically, which was also a part of it, but also the fact that you don't want any chips to fall off your table. You know, anything could open the doors for a run on liquidity, which is also why I talk about individuals. What they should do more and more now is try to preserve their own liquidity and take more cash out of the markets or out of banks to just have on the side during the period of volatility before we have the actual crash, you know, while it's still in a tenuous situation.
Well, I mean, for somebody like you to say, whew, go out, go to your bank and buy and get cash, you wrote that this is money you can hold, or it's the difference between money you can hold and money the banks can take away. And you're saying take some cash out of the bank. Right, and you're afraid of a bail-in, is that right?
There are discussions. I'm afraid of different things that look like a bail-in up to the level of a bail-in, right? Because anything from further reductions in the amount of ATM withdrawals, extra fees on managing savings accounts, which don't provide any interest anyway, extra fees on checking accounts, on small business accounts, all of these things are actually ways for banks to keep your money and to take your money away. These are increasing on a kind of regular basis in the wake of having also zero interest rates that banks are allowed to not pay for your money. So this is happening. That's kind of a low-level bail-in, if you will. Now, there's also been, and you've talked about it, others have talked about it, a lot more documentation coming from the major banks saying it would be good not to have cash, effectively. It would be good for everything to be electronic because that would mean it's all controllable, it's all traceable, it's all stoppable if banks need it. That's the last bastion of liquidity to banks. If they fear that at some point the central banks won't be able to continue what they're doing or find new ways to do exactly what they're doing, and there is a liquidity crunch, then the sensible thing from their perspective to do is to be able to either take or stop the withdrawal of people's cash. And so that's where these papers are coming from. It's not an accident that they're happening now. It's banks saying, look, we've ridden this thing for 7 years. Maybe we ride it for another year. Maybe ride it for another two. But you know what? What's another thing that we can look to in terms of preserving ourselves? Oh, wait, cash, people's deposits. You know, we have those. How can we keep them? How can we stop people withdrawing if we don't want them to? And that's their argument. And so you look at Greece, which closed its banks and then, you know, obviously just opened its banks. That was not quite a bail-in, but it was definitely an obstruction of cash. There was a reason for it, right? It was, you know, because of what was happening in Greece in particular. But big banks here can use that reason to continue to promote this idea that they should have more control over our cash. So I fear that. I see that. And that's why I think it's important for people to just front run that a bit for their own sake. It's a little bit safer now than gold is now.
Cash.
Yes.
That was Nomi Prinz speaking with Greg Hunter on Greg's show, USAWatchdog.com. Please note that this isn't offered to you as financial advice. It's just for you to put in your pipe for smoking. Today's program, indeed a number of our programs, have focused on the mechanics of how global bankers are operating a casino, in which they use our money to make and manipulate bets. No student of economic history will think that this is a new condition, but now that the power play is clear for all to see, and how it has effectively taken over the role of political entities from cities and entire countries, let's call it like it is, a supranational force that can overrun and overrule local control and democratic institutions. Here's an interesting comment that was made by Zbigniew Brzezinski, a former U.S. Secretary of State, back in 1969, referring to the lack of any national allegiance by global financiers. Brzezinski said, "The nation-state as a fundamental unit of man's organized life has ceased to be the principal creative force. International banks and multinational corporations are acting and planning in terms that are far in advance of the political concepts of the nation-state." End quote. So we observe, as our colleague Robert Bowes wrote 2 years ago, the undoing of Detroit as another example of finance gone wrong. This is pertinent today because we've seen Greece and Ireland and Iceland and Cyprus and Argentina and others face off against the power of global finance. Bob Bowes said this, "As we watch the vultures descend from the upper reaches of the power pyramid to pick over the carcass that once was Detroit, it occurs to us that this serves as a textbook example of the ever-accelerating strategy employed by the world's 1/10,000th of a percent to steal all natural and manufactured planetary assets, the fruits of our labor, as well as serving as a cautionary tale to the rest of the world. Our shadow analysis runs like this. 1. The principal objective of global capital is profit and acquisition of the power that enables it. 2. Global capital has no allegiance to nations. 3. Maximizing profits means acquiring cheaper labor and resources while forcing lower taxes. And 4. Global capital controls the creation of money and the regulation of credit, as well as all key corporations, governments, and markets, and manipulates these levers to maximize their profits." Bob continues, "Bereft of income, cities, counties, states, and nations are being forced to sign up for draconian bailouts, as well as the sale of their assets and the privatization of their public services, accompanied by obscene profiteering, all in the name of long-term indebtedness to the banks." End quote. Fast forward now to Puerto Rico, where a recent investigation has exposed that the same billionaires who demanded payment from Puerto Rico also profited from the debt crises in Greece, Argentina, and Detroit. These hedge funds specialize in buying up distressed assets and pushing governments to take on debt they can't afford under predatory rates and conditions. At the same time, the groups are lobbying Congress to not allow the island to declare bankruptcy, as doing so would cut into their profits. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that in 87 bond deals since 2006, Puerto Rico sold $61 billion in bonds, resulting in fees of $1.4 billion to Wall Street. Well, that story goes on and on, but the thread and the message are all very clear. We have a systemic issue of relying on private banks for the issuance of our money. It is, after all, our money. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's On Money. Ellen Brown.